Good afternoon and welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Got to start off the show today by thanking Paul Lindsay here in the control room. Last week, Paul, at 3:01, we moved from outdoors at Clover High School into an office, and we're live at 3:05. I mean, there was a butt connector in the Ethernet cord they gave me that just was clicking on and off, and that's why we kept losing each other. Paul hung in there with me. Probably wasn't my best show because I was just, you know, blood pressure was probably 300 over 500, and it was okay. Thank you, sir. appreciate Geddes being on with me last week. He hauled me around like Wiley and got some good on the water pictures that a lot of parents are enjoying and the kids are enjoying over the past week. So, good time at Riley's Catching. Thanks, Paul. I got another Paul to thank because the other one's sitting here in the studio with us. It's my brother, Paul Metz.
Hello.
Hello.
How you doing?
I hope you're not that short the rest of the show.
No. Okay. We're going to talk about corn and game cameras.
We can hit on corn and game cameras. As long as it does not leave the woods and get on the water, we start discussing fish finders and fishing. You know, I don't know how many of you have brothers and, you know, we've been brothers now for what, 50 years?
Ever since you were born.
Ever since I was born. I remember when you were born.
Yeah. It's an amazing fact.
You know, we've hunted together our whole lives, essentially. We fished a lot together. I mean, we've had some great, great trips. Mm-hmm. 1990, Colorado.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back. And last Friday was the 159th birthday of Teddy Roosevelt. And there's a big, out west, there's a big debate going on about public lands and the future of them. States want control of them, and which is a Republican idea.
Yeah.
A socialist idea is to leave it with the government. So you're caught between a rock and a hard place. Yeah, you're really conflicted.
I'm a land socialist, I'm finding out.
Yeah, you are.
The terror was terrifying me.
It's okay, though, for certain things. I guess socialism has its place.
It's no end of my hypocrisy, apparently.
Yeah, okay. Which one was that, Tombstone? Or
That's Tombstone.
That's Tombstone. Yeah. Okay. But with Teddy Roosevelt's birthday and the debate going on with public lands out west and which could filter over to public lands here in South Carolina. It's something I wanted to deal with. And Paul is as much of a Teddy Roosevelt guy as I know.
I don't know. I went through a period of about 10 years where I just read everything I could on him. I probably got 15 or 16 books at home on him, and I'm kind of cooled a little bit now. I guess I ran out of books to read,
right.
But it's been endlessly fascinating to me, you know?
Amazing man. Just when you, most of us know, you know, okay, he was the president of the United States around 1900. Okay. But you don't know his childhood, his upbringing, what he went through, what made the man, and then why he became such a conservationist. You know, 230 million acres.
Yeah.
While he was president.
Yeah.
Conserved, and we'll get to that. I don't want to ruin it all now in the introduction. But anyway, Paul's with me today. We're gonna have a good time. There's no format today. We're just gonna bounce around from one thing to the next. One of us may end up sobbing on the floor. I mean, it's amazing when you start talking about, and I guess because you go out there and. Probably goes back to our roots. You know, we grew up in the country.
Yeah.
But there were no deer.
Yeah.
And I think that viewpoint of not having a resource, seeing it come in and be such a resource, your view is different on hunting.
Yeah.
And lands and all that than it is if you were born in, you know, 1990.
Yeah. We've kind of lived it, you know, kind of seen it, in some people say we're in the glory days right now, or maybe we're a little bit past them, but we've kind of lived that, and plus going out and experiencing the, you know, the freedom of Western lands and public lands and stuff. So it gets you. It does. Yeah.
It does get you.
Thing, yeah.
I hate to say it this way, but it's a religious experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a sunrise wherever you are is the promise of a new day.
Sure.
It's a religious experience every time you go out.
I mean, you know, to me, the experience in the natural world in any way points me to God.
Yeah.
You know, which is a different than the natural world being God.
Right.
It's different than it pointing you to God. So yeah, it is a religious experience.
And that tends to make us a little weepy eyed around here for some reason or another. He were reading a Teddy Roosevelt quote and he got about three quarters of the way through and he goes, God, I can't do this.
I can't do this.
And he jumps on me when I do, you know, when I get through with the show and I have one of those moments. He'll, yeah, I don't know why you put yourself through that.
Yeah,
well. So anyway, and you're the one that wrote the song about Granddaddy.
Yeah, let's go down that road.
Anyway, that's what it's going to be about. Before we get to all that, let me do a short calendar of events brought to you by Visit Anderson Green Pond Landing and Event Center. If, you know, we were supposed to have the Friends of Lake Robinson Day celebration back in October. It's been rescheduled. It's coming up this Saturday, November the 11th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. There's actually a website, the Friends of Lake Robinson. You can go there and get more information. I'm not sure exactly who's going to be there. I'm still trying to figure out if I can make it or not. But it's going to be a good day. It'll be a good day to get outdoors. Just like yesterday. We did a short trip out in the mountains yesterday, and it was just great. If you want to get hands-on, there's something really cool coming to the Palmetto Shooting Complex down in Edgefield, South Carolina. It's Savage. Savage Arms is having it has a trigger tour, and it's coming November the 18th, the National Wild Turkey Federation, the Palmetto Shooting Complex. And the quip goes like this. We look forward to meeting you on the road. Experience the accuracy, power, and reliability of Savage Firearms when the trigger tour makes a stop at a range near you. These free events are open to the public and allow shooters to try multiple Savage firearms outfitted with Bushnell optics, fueled by Federal Premium and CCI ammunition. So that's something. If you want to get done at the Palmetto Shooting Complex, go try out some Savage rifles, shotguns, whatever. That's for you. Did you eat today?
Did I eat?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, because this is going to make you hungry in the next couple.
Had some kale.
I mean, the deer in Chester don't even eat that stuff.
It's the new chic food, though, right now, you know?
I guess, whatever. Yeah. Sixth annual Smoke on the Harbor Barbecue Throwdown. This is in Charleston, South Carolina. It's going to be held at the Charleston Harbor Marina Resort. This is November the 10th and 11th and 12th. Friday, public sampling of chicken wings. Saturday, public sampling of barbecue pork. This is a Kansas City Barbecue Society event. General admission is $10. You bring 5 canned goods for a food drive. It's $5. Kids and 12 and under are free. Sampling tickets, $2 is one ticket for a 2-ounce sample. Anyway, Charleston Harbor Marina and Resort sounds like a place I need to be.
It's not a barbecue festival, but they don't have mustard-based barbecue.
Well, they'll have that, I'm sure.
Okay, we'll make sure.
I mean, there's a bunch of barbecue teams going down there to compete.
But so. You said Kansas City. I'm thinking, they don't know anything about mustard-based barbecue.
Well, they just judge it, but they judge all of them.
Okay, all right.
It wouldn't be it's not barbecue if it's that vinegar-based stuff.
Whatever that North Carolina Shelby stuff is.
Hilton Head Oyster Festival, November 10th, 11th, and 12th, Friday and Saturday, Sunday. All you can eat steamed local oysters, low country boil, pulled pork, seafood chowder, and chili. It's at the Shelter Cove Pavilion. They're going to have live music. Going to have football games on TV for you to watch. Bands and entertainment. On Friday, Saturday, more oysters, more food, more bands. Sunday, oyster brunch at Hudson Seafood Restaurant. Just a lot of good food. So that's Hilton Head, South Carolina. If you want to go to a couple of banquets, here you go. National Wild Turkey Federation, the Edgefield chapter is having their Hunting Heritage Banquet November the 16th at 6 p.m. at the Old Kendall Mill. Theirs is kind of cool because they're going to be collecting toys, new and opened, at the door to be donated to Sarah's Santa. Please bring a toy with you to be entered into a special drawing for a chance to win a gun. One ticket per toy, and bring as many toys as you can to get entered. And the Sandlapper branch of the South Carolina of the QDMA is having their fall festival November 16th, R.H. Acres in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Kim Leverich is from Department of Natural Resources is your contact. And this fall festival and turkey shoot have a lot of different activities, including an archery turkey shoot with the Genesis bows. Arrows are $5 for 5 shots. Archery games, face painting, a whole bunch of other stuff. So, a few things to get you started. If you don't like any of those, take a drive up in the mountains. The leaves are great. Weather's just perfect. Hang on through the break. We'll be back with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Woods and Water, South Carolina. In addition to being just a brother and a good hunter, my Paul is an accomplished guitarist and all, and he was, you know.
I've had a hard time not playing air guitar with your music.
That's our kind of music.
I'm trying to sing along with it, though.
Yeah. Voices have changed. Too much to sing. I mean, we can't sing like we used to.
No, neither can John Bon Jovi.
That's true.
He can't hit the high notes
he
anymore.
Can't. Gosh. Pagosa Springs, Colorado.
Yeah.
1990.
Young Guns 2. Wasn't that the theme song to it?
I think it was.
Yeah, that was a good...
One row with like four seats on either side. Theater in downtown Pagosa Springs, Colorado.
Yeah, and the girl that was minding it, she took your money for the ticket, fixed your snacks, and cleaned up after you, and ran the projector, yeah. All of it. It was great.
One of those times, you know? It's and you were sick. You didn't feel
good. Sick. But, you know, that day we had just gone through Lincoln, New Mexico, which is where that movie was set.
That's right.
So we were primed for a really...
We even went to the jail where they supposed to have the bullet hole in the wall covered with plexiglass. Yeah, we were ready for that movie that night.
Yeah, we thought we were Billy the Kid.
Oof. Franks. That was the sporting goods store we went and bought our elk tags at.
I remember that. Okay, I remember the store. I don't remember Franks.
Franks. But, like I said, this show is going to be, you know, deer season's here. You know, we introduced a tagging system in South Carolina to try to help our deer herds. You know, our population was skyrocketed through the 80s into the 90s, peaked out. Now kind of on a downward trend. Part of that has to do with habitat loss. Part of it has to do with habitat itself, the forest, you know, state of the forest. We had a lot of hardwoods that were cut, which, you know, like coyote, a lot of
coyote depredation.
Coyote depredation, you know, effective hunters.
Yeah.
You know, so it sparked a lot of talk about conservation and, you know, people's true natures come out on these social websites and all, but it just, and then I saw something on the 159th birthday of Teddy Roosevelt, who is really the father.
I keep waiting for somebody to say, I'm coming to your house right now. Say that to my face on Facebook, but, you know, on the websites.
We're all 6'5" and 300 pounds behind the computer screen.
I'm coming over right now.
That's right.
You say that to my face. Anyway, sorry.
But Teddy Roosevelt is kind of he is the father of modern conservation. And I thought it'd be a good idea just to history behind it. You know, a lot of us don't know about where we were at the turn of the century in the United States, the natural resources and what had happened to it all. So I thought it'd be good. And look, this is meant to either, you know, inspire you to do more and go out and do some research on your own, become a better conservationist, whether you hunt, fish, hike, whatever. You know, we're all in this boat together. There's only so much of this public resource out there.
Yeah.
And all of us have to have a vested interest in it or none of it survives.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the term conservation. Like you say, got its start right around the turn of the two centuries ago.
Now I don't want to go to the last one.
That's right.
But anyway, let's talk about a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt's childhood and kind of before he became president type thing. Cause he was not what you would consider an outdoorsman by birth.
No, he was born in New York City, in New York City, city boy.
To very wealthy parents.
Yeah, in that time. And he was sickly, had terrible bouts of asthma, very poor eyesight. You know, he was like 11 or 12 years old before they realized he needed glasses. They found out that because his dad bought him a shotgun. And he went bird shooting, and people would say, there's one shooting. He's looking up where. He couldn't even see the birds, and nobody knew it because he didn't have glasses. And But, you know, one of the interesting things about that is because he couldn't see well, nobody knew it, he became very attuned to sounds, which really got him started into birds. And he was big on birds. He set up several bird refuges and all that, too. So his childhood kind of being sickly, you know, it set him up. He was interested in animals that he could find around. Now, there's one story about a seal that died in the New York Harbor that somebody laid it out. I guess it was wintertime, and it wasn't going to decompose too much, but they laid it out on the street corner on some display there. And he went down every day for like several weeks and looked at that seal, you know. And but he wasn't an outdoors, it was a weakling, you know.
What did his daddy tell him, though?
His dad said, you know, Theodore, you've got Teedy. They called him Teedy at the time.
Not Teddy, but Teedy.
Teedy. They said, Teedy, you've got the mind, but you've got to make your body. And his dad kind of threw down the gauntlet on that challenge, and he went to it lifting weights and boxing and all kind of things. And he did. He single-handedly overcame his asthma and his physical deficiencies in that way. Went on to box at Harvard and play some sports there and all.
So through Harvard?
Interestingly enough, at the end of his when he graduated, they had an exit physical then. And the doctor told him that he had a very bad heart and that he could not do anything strenuous for the rest of his life. And he said he purposed in his mind to do exactly the opposite, and that's what he did. And in fact, one of his most famous speeches is the strenuous life. You know,
yes.
He really but yeah, he graduated from Harvard and got married right out of Harvard. And then some people convinced him to run for the New York legislature. So he was like one of the youngest people ever elected to the New York legislature at that time. Made a lot of enemies because everywhere he went, he was not a lay down and take it guy. He had his opinions.
Mob buster too.
Yeah.
Later on in life.
But, you know, I think the thing that kind of probably one of the central things of his life at that time is while he was at the New York legislature, his wife was at home. She was pregnant. I was expecting their first child, and he got a telegram, said, you better get on a train right now if you want to see, you know, your wife or your mother alive again. And, you know, he had to go from Albany to New York, which is a couple, 3 hours by train. But anyway, I think he got there to see one of them. But anyway, his wife and his mother died in the same house on the same day. And he just kind of went, you know, crazy with grief and, went west, bought a ranch.
North Dakota.
In North Dakota, yeah. Medora, which is now his ranch lands are a national park out there now. But when we say bought a ranch, he essentially bought a log cabin in the middle of the Badlands of North Dakota with some cows on it. And, he lived out there for 3 years on that ranch with his ranch hands, participating in the roundup and the branding and everything that went on. And of course, at that time, he did a lot of hunting and things too. And that's where he kind of fell in love with the land and common people, being a New York rich city guy. He didn't know. And then those things really kind of defined the rest of his life, his love of common people and that those were the people that made the country and his love of outdoors and the land and the need to conserve it.
Yeah, because he saw it firsthand what was happening out there.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, the best estimates, you know, there were 40 million buffalo when the country was first discovered by Europeans. And at that time, there was about 1,800 left. Today, there's about 500,000. At the time of European discovery, there was 24 million white-tailed deer. There's about 500,000 left at that time when he was out there, and there are about 30 million today. Is actually more than there was then. Elk went from 10 million down to 150,000. Now they're back up to over a million. Things were at pretty low ebb right then out west.
And somewhere I read that, you know, as a rancher, overgrazing.
Yeah.
You know, he lost pretty much his whole cow herd or whatever because of overgrazing in the wintertime.
Yeah, the winter of 1888, I think. Mm-hmm. It was the worst winter ever. It was kind of the one that ended the open range, and that's when they started fencing stuff. But I know he lost almost the whole herd, and they froze, and they found cows on the tops of trees because the snow was so deep. They were in it was crazy, you know.
An experience like that will shape your life or change it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it comes back to the East?
Yeah, you know, he couldn't, the East and the politics just couldn't get that out of his blood, you know. So, he came back East and, became a police commissioner in New York City. And, you know.
That'll earn you some friends.
Yeah,
in the 1880s, 90s.
He did some stuff there, including he would go out at night and roam around at night in disguise looking for policemen that weren't doing their job. And, he just, everything unconventional and, from police commissioner, he went to, he got an appointment as assistant secretary of the Navy. I think it was the next place he went. In 1898, when the Spanish American War broke out, he resigned as secretary of the Navy, volunteered at age 42, I think, to go and fight wanted to raise a regiment of common people and rich people. So he got, you know, all these people from the East and the West and cowboys and Ivy League guys and formed this regiment called the Rough Riders.
And of course, good movie, too.
Yeah, great movie. Mm-hmm. Great movie. Tom Berenger in it and all. Yep. And he became a national hero in Cuba when he charged, led the Rough Riders up San Juan Hill. Came back from there, national hero, was a shoe-in for governor of New York. And then they wanted to get rid of him. You know, I guess he was kind of the Trump of his day. They all hated him, the Republican establishment. And so they came up with a scheme to get rid of him, and that was to nominate him for vice president. So they did, and they talked him into going for vice president. He became vice president, and just a few weeks into the term, President McKinley was assassinated, and he became president. Yeah. And somebody was heard to say, you know, now that blank cowboy is the president. And, it was shockwaves. Sure was.
Shockwaves, but from a hunter's standpoint, from an outdoor standpoint, I mean, just providential.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was still time to save a lot of the natural resources that, you know, mining, timber, railroad, you know, those are great industries, but they had their excesses during that time. Sure. You know, you had the huge bankers and the big industrialists, the Carnegies and all those, and they were really burning through the resources. And
market hunting. Decimating population.
Yeah, you could go into any restaurant and buy a wild game.
That's right.
That was killed out, and it just the wild resource can't take that type of commercialization. And he realized he and his friends.
So that's that brings him up through the presidency, and in the beginning of the effect with conservation. Yeah, he kind of imputed on the country.
Yeah, I mean, in the late 1880s, he became the conservationist, but he couldn't do anything about it until he became president. And then he undertook a series of executive orders setting aside over 230 million acres of national forests.
That's 230 million acres we don't have to pay for. Well, we pay for taxes, but we can go to it anytime we want.
Yeah, it's our land.
Gas and truck ride.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Hang on through the break. Be back with more on Teddy Roosevelt, my brother Paul, on Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Foreigner.
Yeah.
Lead singer.
It just left me.
It left me.
I'm sorry. He had a brain tumor. I can tell you a lot about him, but Lou Reed.
Lou Graham.
Lou Graham.
There we go.
There we go.
All right.
Got that behind us.
There we go.
That would have worried me all night. Lou Graham.
I'd ask Siri sometime during next break.
That's cheating.
That's cheating. Go ahead.
You know, I guess when we think about the impact of what he did, you know, I've been hunting before out west, you know, and I've been out there 8 or 9 times, I guess, and sat in a, you know, on a mountainside looking at a valley and appreciating and just thought, you know, if this hadn't been set aside, what a half a dozen bulldozers could do in a day. I mean, it would be gone and never to be again in its form, you know. So it's that thing of preserving it like that is such a service to us now. But the other thought I've had going out there is, out west, you know, is, you know, where else in the world can four guys, you know, load up a pickup truck in South Carolina with guns and ammo, camping gear, drive 1700 miles across 6 states or 7 states to the road ends, dirt road ends.
And there's a gate says no trespassing, no vehicles further than this.
No vehicles further than this. And fortunately, the cell phone doesn't work then. And you just get out of the truck and hike in the mountains into a 200,000 or 300,000 acre wilderness area without asking anybody.
Yeah.
You ask nobody's permission to do that. And, you know, I mean, that's such, there's no other country in the world you could do that. And it's certainly different than the European model where, you know, the king owns the land, the deer, all that. And, you know, we set out for something new here and, you know, Roosevelt kind of put the finishing touches on it when we're talking about hunting and wild lands and access. He believed the common people. He believed there was something good for the soul of a common man being able to go out and experience this, these expanses and these natural places. And he kind of thought it was part of the natural character building process for, you know, like we're better.
And, you know, we talk about the West. There are national forests here. You got Sumter National Forest, yeah. Francis Marion National Forest. I mean, it's out West. That's where the
Andrew
Lions,
Pickens,
the Pickens yeah. district up there.
Yeah.
But out West is just kind of where it started. And it, you know, yeah. so there is some here that you can go experience. You know, there's
some great national forests here.
There sometimes are. Underutilized.
Yeah, we really kind of skip over a lot of that because we think of the big stuff out West, but, things like the Chattooga National Wild and Scenic River
and
Corridor.
There are a bunch, haven't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, and you get in there, you could be the first person ever to see that, you know?
Or the first person to die out there.
Yeah.
Well, that's an experience we'll talk about one of these days,
right,
too.
Yeah, later. But there's lots of things here up in North Carolina, you know, Cherokee National Forest, yep. lots of national forests up there, Tennessee, Great Smoky Mountains. You know, sometimes it's easy to overlook things that are closest to home.
Yeah.
But, anyway.
So he comes back president.
Yeah.
And that's where it really, you know, executive order has kind of gotten the bad name because a lot of political stuff is done with executive orders these days.
Yeah. The things I scream about every day at my television
right.
for the past 8 or 9 years, he did to establish these, you know, and, it's
puts you in a jam, doesn't it?
It does, you know, and I guess President Obama did the same thing Roosevelt did. Well, he just took some federal lands already and reclassified them, which put them in a more protected status than they were before.
Bear's Ears in Utah being one of those.
Yeah, Clinton before that did the Joshua Tree thing, mm-hmm. I think. So it's just still the same. It's the same movement. And I guess you got to ask yourself, you know, where is enough, and when does it need to stop? And that's the debate will probably go on for forever.
Never.
But he did it with executive orders, and you know, there's one story that Congress was tired of it, and they were the mining and timber and railroad; those are the big three that hated him because of it, because they wanted access to these lands. And they'd kind of gotten Congress in, believe it or not, Congress can kind of be influenced and bought with lobbyists.
You think?
Yeah, they can. And,
so can the Democrat National Party too.
And, they came with a law to stop Roosevelt and all that he was doing with this. And, they sent it to him and they had enough votes to override his veto. And so he and his Secretary of the Interior spent a week. He had 3 days that he had to either sign it or veto it. And so he asked his attorney general, is there anything stopping me from setting aside land at this time before this law goes into effect? And he said no. So he and his Secretary of the Interior spread maps out. Story goes they spread maps of the West all over the Oval Office floor and crawled around on those maps with pencils and pens marking off areas for 3 days over a long weekend. And then at the end of the weekend, by executive order, he said, I think it was 93 new national designations. And then he signed the bill and sent it back to Congress. And so he got his last jab in. And, you know, it was, but that was right there at the end, a huge step.
230 million acres. Some of the national parks he Crater Lake, Wind Cave, Sully's Hill Platte, Mesa Verde, Yosemite. I mean, a lot of these places you and I've been to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he instituted the Federal Bird Reserve, which is now, the National Wildlife Refuge System.
Yeah, yeah.
The U.S. Forest Service, he created that. You know, you start doing your research on him, and you run into names like Gifford Pinchot, you know, the U.S. Director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Forest Service. George Bird Grinnell, Audubon Society, Forest and Stream Editor, John Muir, Naturalist. You know, those are some heavy hitters.
Yeah, I've got a cup at home that my daughter and son-in-law gave me. It's one of those cups that I forget what you call them, but it's the rage now that won't condense. It's an insulated cup. Anyway, it in the outside it says the mountains are calling and I must go, and it's a quote by John Muir. So. But, you know, it's just a time in history where they, you know, they took a look at what we had and said, we're not going to let this go away.
Roosevelt's quotes, I mean, there's so many of them out there that talk about the resources, you know. We've become great because of the lavish use of our resources, but the time has come to inquire seriously what will happen when our forests are gone, when the coal, the iron, the oil, the gas are exhausted, when the soils have still further impoverished and washed into the streams, polluting the rivers, denuding the fields, and obstructing navigation.
Yeah. As another one here, speaking about national forests, one of his speeches he gave, he said, we've fallen heirs to the most glorious heritage a people ever received, and each one must do his part if we wish to show that the nation is worthy of its good fortune. One of the things he saw too is there's got to be different levels. I mean, you've got like national parks, national monuments, national forest, Bureau of Land Management. And you know, there are some things that are so unique, say the Grand Canyon or something like that.
Right.
It deserves total protection status. There are other expanses that are just millions and millions of acres of forest that deserves not to be developed, but it also needs to be used wisely.
Right.
What's the term?
Multi-use.
Yeah, that's kind of been the, for 100 years now, has been the kind of the charge of the Forest Service and the Department of the Interior, to where it's not just, okay, only bird watchers can do this, or only fishermen can use this, or only hunters, or only hikers, or only, you know, pick your whatever you enjoy doing outdoors. It's, we're going to manage these so that, you know, that they're used for multiple purposes by millions of people. And so far, it's been tremendously successful. It's tough because there's a strong movement out there that just wants to put all these lands off limit and make it essentially, we can't touch it.
Yeah.
And, that flies in the face of our history and what has made us unique in the world in these, public lands, because they're for public use, not to be set aside as a museum.
Yeah. He talks about Yellowstone a lot. He talks about Yosemite a lot, you know, that some of these places are just don't need to be touched at all.
Yeah.
Total set asides.
Yellowstone was a big issue when we talked a few minutes ago, I think, about it founding the Boone and Crockett Club, and that was one of their big – Yellowstone was the first national park in the history of the world. Nobody in the world had ever thought of setting aside a national park, and they did it, but it was more in name only. The Army was in control of it, and people just did what they wanted to pretty much, and as long as, you know, nobody was screaming or getting killed, the Army kind of left it alone. But, you know, they came in and said, look, this needs to be protected. They made it created the Forest Service, National Park Service, and put under that. And, Roosevelt saw Yosemite. I mean, not Yosemite. That's another story, but saw Yellowstone as, let's call it a nursery for wildlife. That all of this wildlife, elk, deer, buffalo, all of them could go there and be protected, you know, multiply, but they could come out into the national forest and would be, you know, could be pursued for hunting or wildlife watching or whatever. So it was interesting.
And now you got the reintroduction of the wolves in Yellowstone, which has created another problem.
Oh, yeah.
They've got no natural predators.
Yeah.
And now you've seen, I know people talk about, you go to Yellowstone, you just don't see the game that you used to.
Yeah.
One of those feel-good things. Oh, we need to reintroduce this. But once man has entered into the equation, it's not going to go back to being pristine anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's a fallacy. There's a balance to nature. There's not a balance. There's just extreme swings of predator and prey and die-offs and shortages, and man balances it.
Yeah.
Nature doesn't balance.
Hang on through the break. We're going to come back and do one more segment on this for today, and hope you'll call somebody and tell them to listen in. Back with more Woods and Water, South Carolina on the other side. Champagne Jam.
Yeah, do you know Ronnie Hammond, lead singer's dad? He died about 3 years ago for Atlanta Rhythm Section.
We're losing so many of the good ones.
Oh, yeah.
So many of the good ones.
Yeah.
And you look back at those opportunities you had to see them when they were.
Oh, yeah.
They were when. What? Okay, your biggest regret, Boston, Spartanburg Auditorium, 77.
Yeah. First tour, Spartanburg Auditorium. I had somebody invite me to go, and I'm like, nah, I got to work tonight. I worked at Hardee's. I also had somebody offer me a ticket to go see Lynyrd Skynyrd's last concert here in town. It was the day before the crash, and I had to work. I was working at Hardee's. I said, nah, I can't go.
Wow.
I woke up the next morning. Mom said, Paul, you know that Skinny Winnie group? I said, Mom, you mean Lynyrd Skynyrd? She goes, yeah, well, they died in a plane crash last night.
Oh, no. Love. You know, you talk about all the things that Teddy did, and the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History opened its doors in 1867. He shared his collection in 1871. He donated everything to the American Museum of Natural History.
That was his childhood collection.
Yeah.
They said they didn't want to go in his room because it smelled like arsenic, which is what they put on the,
unreal.
To preserve the hides back then.
You know, founded Boone and Crockett Club. Boone and Crockett Club, I want to, real quickly, because fair chase is another issue that's come up in deer hunting with a lot of things that are affecting our hunting and issues that we're going to have to deal with. But fair chase.
Corn.
Game cameras.
Corn.
You know what game cameras have done for deer hunting?
What?
Made a lot of frustrated hunters. Corn, feeding corn has been proven, study done. Yeah. Corn makes deer go nocturnal.
Yeah.
Oh. Because they don't have to forage.
Okay. Yeah.
They know where it's going to be.
Yeah.
That's why you have so many nighttime pictures of all these deer eating corn. Because studies have shown that when you start feeding corn, deer change their feeding habits.
So now deer hunters are just as frustrated as people that play golf.
Yeah.
Have you ever met a happy golfer? They're always upset about their golf game.
Well, Phil Mickelson seems to be.
Well, I'm talking about regular people like us.
Okay.
You know.
I don't know. They're always working to get better. I don't know. But I think it has it. But anyway, fair chase. The ethical, sportsmanlike, and lawful pursuit and taking of any free-ranging wild native North American big game animal in a manner that does not give the hunter an improper advantage over such animals.
Makes you want to stand up and put your hand over your heart, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, there is an ethic, and obviously it's self-imposed. We can wipe out the game if we wanted to, but we choose to nurture them, harvest a few animals out of the population for particular uses, food, but leave the basic species and the habitat intact. And that's what fair chase does, you know.
There's a story about Teddy and how he got his name. This is pretty cool. Yeah. And this kind of speaks to the, what was it? Oh, there was a video that came out from the National Deer Alliance that talks about this old tree stand.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And in there it says it has seen me when my ethics were tested.
Right, right.
Great story about Teddy and ethics.
You want me to tell the story?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Teddy, he was, of course, everybody when he was president wanted him to come hunt with them, and he went several places. I'm always intrigued by the time he was hunting in Colorado, and he attended a country church service when nobody knew he was even around, and all of a sudden the president is at the front door of this church in the middle of nowhere in Colorado. But anyway, he got this invitation to go to Mississippi on a black bear hunt, and that was when, you know, there were plenty of black bears in Mississippi at that time in the swamps down there. And one of the guides, in order to please the president, you got the president to come, you want to have a good time, you know?
You want the game to move when the president's
that's
around.
That's right. You wanted, so they figured the best way to ensure the president had a good time, they caught a small bear and tied him up to a tree and took the president out there to shoot the bear. And they thought this was doing him a favor. And, you know, Roosevelt ended up reading them the Riot Act and refused to shoot the bear tied to the tree. And it became a big national story. There's political cartoons of him, you know, turning his back on the bear and saying no and all this. And after that incident happened, there was some toy company up in New England contacted him and wanted to know. They were marketing a stuffed bear, and they wanted to know if they could have his permission to call it the Teddy Bear. And he gave them permission, and what, 120 years later, we still have teddy bears. Yeah.
Now you know, as Paul Harvey would say it, the rest of the story. Another great one. You know, Teddy, there is a delight in the hearty life of the open. There are no words that can tell the hidden spirit of the wilderness that can reveal its mystery, its melancholy, and its charm. The nation behaves well if it treats the natural resources as assets, which it must turn over to the next generation, increased and not impaired in value.
Yeah.
1910.
Yeah.
Osawatomie, Kansas.
Yeah.
One of his best speeches ever. after the presidency, you know, when he again turned towards what he loved to do, being outdoors.
Yeah, and there's something restorative about outside and outdoor pursuits that I think it builds character. It kind of reveals who you really are when you're out there when nobody can see what
you're
doing.
That's exactly right.
You can I think he realized that it was part of the national character that was important. He went on one of his last great adventures in 1913. He was 55, and a group of scientists invited him to go on an Amazon River expedition. They were going to explore this tributary way up into the Amazon jungle, and he when he was questioned about going, everybody, he's 55, and people were saying, no, you shouldn't go. And of course, he's an ex-president and all, and his response was, I have to go. It's my last chance to be a boy. You know, so even at 55, he was still. I remember one thing reading, they said that Mrs. Roosevelt actually has 7 children, 6 plus Teddy. but he almost died on that expedition. In fact, he caught some type of bad infection, fever down there in the jungle, and begged them to leave him for dead, and they wouldn't do it. And they got him out of there, but he never was healthy again after that. And pretty much downhill for the last 4 years of his life. Died in 1919. He had a son that was a fighter pilot in World War I, flying biplanes.
Yep.
And he was shot down and killed during the war. And they say between the fever from the jungle and the grief over the son, he just never recovered, you know, went downhill from there. There's several good books.
Yeah.
One is The Lion's Pride, and the pride is the family of the lion, you know, Teddy's right. The lion. And this is a story about all of his children and what they accomplished. And it's really amazing to read what a father's influence is on their children. It's called The Lion's Pride. Another one, his kind of 3 big books on outdoors and hunting that I like, Hunting Trips of a Ranch Man, The Wilderness Hunter, and Outdoor.
That was pretty much during the time he was out
He wrote them about that 3 or 4 year period he was out there. And Outdoor Pastimes of an American Hunter. Innumerable other books. I guess the definitive biography on Roosevelt is by Edmund Morris, who by chance happens to be Ronald Reagan's biographer too. But he wrote a 3-volume trilogy on Roosevelt. It was like 1 volume for before he was president, 1 volume while he was president, and 1 volume for after he was president. They're all about 600 pages long. But if you read that one, you know it.
You got a big one over there too.
Yeah, this one is by Douglas Brinkley. It's called The Wilderness Warrior, and it's 800 pages on just it's called Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. It's about his conservation efforts during that time, and it's an amazing book.
What did we flag in there? We put something there.
Yeah, but I copied it down. It's about wildlife and the numbers and all. Yeah. So great, some great books there if somebody wants to learn more about Roosevelt.
The man should have youth and strength who seeks adventure in the wild, waste spaces of the earth and the marshes and among the great vast mountain masses in the northern forest amid the streaming jungles of the tropics or on the desert of sand or of snow. He must long greatly for the lonely winds that blow across the wilderness and for sunrise and sunset over the rim of the empty world.
Yeah. You know, at the same time when he was doing all this stuff, he knew 3 or 4 languages. Yeah. He wrote about 20 books that he wrote personally. In fact, if you ask him what his job or his vocation was, he considered himself an author. That's what he did to make money before he got in politics and during that time. But this is my favorite Roosevelt quotation right here. You know, he's got, some people say that if you want to know who made America policeman of the world, it's Theodore Roosevelt. He had this dream of the American Navy circumventing the globe. And as of when he was president, it hadn't happened yet.
Right.
And so they did. It was called the Great White Fleet, and they circled the globe, the American Navy, at his bequest. So he had a big vision of America as a world power, and his life just had a lot of facets to it other than the conservation. But this quote I think is great for anybody in their life. He said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. We could use a, not just in conservation, but just in our
general
our general culture and society as a whole today, a little more Teddy Roosevelt fever, for lack of a better term.
Or a direct injection of Teddy.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of embodies what America came to be when it first burst on the world stage. I mean, up to that point, America was really nothing on the world stage, and he put us there. And preserved the wild places at the same time. So,
of all the places we've seen that would be public lands, 15 seconds.
All the places that would be public lands, wow.
That we've seen.
Maroon Bells is the prettiest place I've ever seen. It's in Colorado. It's right in the middle of the state outside of Aspen. It's part of a wilderness area, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's supposed to be the most photographed place. But you got Arches National Park. You've got the Grand Teton.
You spend your life every summer with 2 weeks going somewhere else, couldn't you?
Yeah, and they all have their own particular attraction, you know.
And when you go up to North Carolina, you see the elk. When you see wild turkeys beside the road, wood ducks, white-tailed deer. Probably trace it back to Teddy.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, in his cohorts. Yeah.
All right. Make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. Thanks, Paul, for being here.
And don't forget the camera.
See you next week. In my mind.